And last night I mentioned an important point, which hopefully you'll keep in mind for the rest of this meditation retreat. It is almost like the goal, if you want to call it a goal, of the meditation is stillness, not concentration. And that word has caused a lot of problems for many people in their meditation practice. And it has made many people give up after a while. They haven't been able to achieve this goal of concentration. And if they do, they get so tense and it's very unpleasant. And it's not the path. The path is something completely different. And it's good to know what that path is and what the goal really is. And then it makes meditation much easier to understand. And it is the path of stillness. Being still. Not allowing the body to move, just relaxing it until it's comfortable by itself. And there's two ways of having a still body, and one of those ways you will see in Buckingham Palace with those horse guards, whatever they're called, who can stand still for an hour on end, even though tourists try and poke them and take photographs of them to try and disturb them. But they can remain still just because of their training in willpower. But that's not a very pleasant state to be in. And even the best soldier on Buckingham Palace will still sort of have to move after an hour or 2 hours. But to be able to be still in your body so you can just be sitting here and not even move is a very difficult thing to do. And it can only be done if you really let the body be. As I said with that glass of water, just leave it alone. It does become still all by itself, which is a wonderful thing to experience. And also it tells you what the path of this meditation is. Letting go leads to stillness, concentration leads to tension. And at least in our modern world, where meditation is used as a stress reduction technique, it should become very clear to people that concentration just stresses you out even more. This is going in the wrong direction. Whereas stillness leads to relaxation, leads to peace and all sorts of other wonderful effects. And I think that just in the old traditions of meditation and hermits and these monks and nuns and these saints living in the mountains, living in the caves, sitting perfectly still with the mind not moving for hours after hours, now that is a romantic idea of what the meditating hermit would be. And this is actually quite accurate to what meditation really is. To be what the Buddha called the hermit in the cave of the mind. Just perfectly still, not moving. Now, if that is the goal of this meditation, then we say, well, you know, what's the point of this, being still? And one of the points, a very good way to connect this to the arising of wisdom, to make it very clear that there is no such thing as, you know, two ways of meditation, you know, one insight, one leading to bliss. These are exactly the same. The only two types of meditation is what I said yesterday, wrong meditation and right meditation. Those are the two types of meditation. The wrong meditation is wanting, leading to suffering. The other type of meditation, letting go of wanting, leading to nirvana, leading to the peace and stillness and happiness and bliss. That is this first teaching of the Buddha, the Dhammacakka Sutta. But when we get to the connection between stillness and insight, it's a very good metaphor when you go down and look at one of the lakes, especially the nice lake down below there. Especially at night time, if there are any waves on the surface of that lake, you will not get an accurate reflection of the stars or the clouds or even the trees on the hillside surrounding that lake. The image will be distorted because of the waves. Even ripples on the surface will distort the image. But if you go one evening or early morning to that lake on a windless night and the water is perfectly still, with not a ripple, not a disturbance on its surface, that lake is like a glass mirror which perfectly and accurately and fully reflects any stars, the moon, forests surrounding it. It is the waves, the disturbances, which distort the truth. So if you want to understand the nature of things and arouse the wisdom which is the cause of enlightenment, your mind has to be perfectly still as a lake on a windless night, and then it will perfectly reflect the truth. Or, as the Buddha said, to make sure that people don't assume I'm making these things up by myself, it's samadhi paccaya yata bhutayana dasana. From stillness. Stillness is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. Through stillness. Now that's an important statement, because it's not through thinking or contemplating you understand things as they truly are, but through stillness. Not through thought, but through this deep stillness of the mind. That's where you understand things as they truly are. Because you can understand your mind like that lake, and you can understand all those thoughts like the waves on the lake. You can't see a clear reflection. So the job in meditation is to learn how to be still. And then you get this mind which can reflect the truth. From stillness arises insight, seeing things as they truly are. And that has always been the way. Oh, as Ajahn Chah used to say, one of the favorite similes of Ajahn Chah, and it was so hard for me to find a place I could publish this. Now, even though it doesn't really fit in my latest book of 108 stories and jokes and stuff, I managed to squeeze this one in there simply because I know of no other book where it has been published. And it was his famous simile which he gave to me the first few months when I was at his monastery, Wat Bapong, where he said that that monastery was a mango orchard where all the trees had been planted by the Buddha. And now, 2,500 years later, every mango tree in this monastery is full of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes. And you monks do not have to climb the tree to get a mango, nor should you shake a tree, nor throw sticks up in the tree to get a mango to fall, which are usually the three ways you get mangoes in a real mango orchard. All you need to do, monks, is to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Open out your hand and a mango will fall in. And that was Ajahn Chah's brilliant simile, which, like many of that similes I learned, and probably much of what you hear on this retreat, you just don't understand. But nevertheless, you know, it has the smell of truth. It's something really fascinating, even though you don't understand it, and you won't be able to forget it, because it doesn't make any sense, but it comes from a great master. It doesn't make any sense you just sit under a tree and a mango will fall right into your hand. Or, as I often joke, if it did fall, where would it likely fall? On top of your head. It'd give you a headache, knowing our luck. But Ajahn Chah said, no, it doesn't fall anywhere but right into your hand, but only if you are still. And it took years and years to understand a simile like that, because I was always shaking the mango tree. I was always struggling, trying to climb up things to get the insights, or to get the stillness, to get the experiences. Trying to throw things up to try and get it. I was always trying to do something to get stillness. And after a while, you know, it never worked. So sometimes, just by chance, you have nice experiences and you look back and you go, wow, that happened because I was still. I wasn't struggling. I was letting go. I was just sitting here without sort of wanting anything. And all these wonderful things just fell. So sitting still under the mango tree, opening your hand is opening out your heart. And all these incredible experiences, they just fall right into you. But you go shaking the tree, you go searching for them, you're destroying stillness. So your job as meditators is to worship stillness and to try and preserve any stillness and allow it to grow and develop. So going back to the simile of the lake, where do those waves come from? Most of the time, because we don't have earthquakes in this part of the world, most of the time those waves come from the wind, which blow along the surface of the lake. And in this simile, if your mind is the lake, the wind is your wanting. Wanting anything, even good things, let alone bad things. That disturbs the mind. It creates thoughts, it creates these waves. Sometimes I would ask, why do we think so much? Where does all that come from? And it is from a lack of contentment. That is why we think. It's important to know things like this, because otherwise you just go battle, trying to stop thinking, trying to make your mind still, trying to fight thoughts, and it never works. And think, 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 stop it. That's another thought. That's another, second thought. Here we go again, another thought. It's just endless and incredibly frustrating. Until you say, no, don't try and stop the thoughts. Stop the causes of the thoughts. Find out where they come from. Why you have to think. And you'll trace it back if you're aware enough and find out it's because you want something. Usually you don't want to be here, you want to be somewhere else. You're not quite sure where else you want to be, but it's certainly not here. And that's usually the meaning of our life. Always wanting to be somewhere else. Not quite sure where, but anywhere than here. And that keeps us moving throughout our life, from experience to experience, from retreat to retreat, from partner to partner, from job to job, land to land, always wanting something else. I'm really not into tourism at all. If you want to see a mountain, this is a hill just behind us over here, that's big enough. If that's not good enough for you, those who live in Perth, go to Mount Hawthorne or Mount Morley, that's a mountain. It's only a tiny hill. If you want to see a waterfall, you don't need to go to Victoria Falls or Niagara Falls. Go in your shower and turn the water on. That's a waterfall. It's only the same, just different size, that's all. You want to see have you seen the Great Wall of China yet? See the Great Wall of Bodhinyana just over the road. That's long enough, that's a wall. So why do people want to go to these things? They go there and often they say, is this it? Is this it? The Great Wall of China? Take your selfie and, yeah, I've been there, done that, another thing to tick off my list. Gee, what a waste of time that is. So, all that wanting is what keeps you moving, which stops you being still, which creates the thoughts. So imagine, just imagine, you may not be able to do this, imagine this moment is totally perfect. You don't want anything, you don't need anything. You're totally happy, totally enclosed and self-sufficient in this one moment. You stop thinking. Thinking is the language of planning, of business, of moving, of trying to get somewhere, do something or achieve something. Or get rid of things as well. When there's no business to be done in your mind, then you're still. So it's a wanting is a problem. That's exactly what the Buddha said in his first teaching. You know, about, as I already mentioned it, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Craving is the cause for suffering. So even craving for good things. So the whole purpose of this meditation is to stop wanting. You know, there's a charity called, it used to be anyway, Freedom from Want. Is that charity still going? Used to be when I was a kid. Freedom from Want. I support that charity. You don't need to give any money. You just have to sit down and meditate and stop it. And imagine when you have got nothing you want. That is, someone asked me, what's the goal of life? And it's actually to end all wanting. Many people try to end all wanting in so many different ways. You got your goals. Okay, I'm going to get my house. I got my house finished. So I shouldn't want anymore. I've got my house now.
Of course, once you've got your house, you want to have your furniture. Once you've got your furniture, you want to have your car. Once you have your car, then you get your partner. When you get your partner, you want to improve them. When you improve them, then you're going to have kids. Then you want to get your kids to do this. And you're just endless, all the wanting. And sometimes you see, read about people in the newspapers, like migrants. All I want is to have a free life, to be free of oppression. That's totally ridiculous. That's not the first thing they want. They've got a whole list and it never ends. Right until the time you're on your deathbed. And what do you want? Heaven, please. If you're a Buddhist, please, Ajahn Brahm, come along and make me a stream winner. I know I've left it a bit long, but please, I need to have a stream winner because otherwise I might get a bad rebirth. Our wanting never finishes in life, except when we come here. All wanting stops here. If you can do that, then you'll have the best meditation you'll ever experience. But it's so tough to stop all your wanting. Because even as Buddhists said, what about the efforts? We have to have goals. If we don't have any goals, we'll be lazy. We'll spend all the rest of the meditation retreat just sleeping and eating and just talking and all this stuff. Give it a try. See if you can have 1 hour of not wanting anything. Because a lot of what we assume to be laziness is not laziness at all, it's restlessness. How many of you can just sit on a chair just outside the kitchen with a cup of tea and actually want nothing at all? What do? We start thinking, fantasizing, dreaming. When I get home, this is what I'll do. This is, even you look at this place and think, oh, maybe we can improve it and do something here and do something there. You probably already designed this retreat center to be a better place. Why is it we can't just stop? Now, one lovely way of stopping, which, sometimes we need these little skillful means, and I was telling it to the Friday night group the other 2 days ago. It's an old simile of mine, but it's a very powerful one. And it is a simile of, actually I told it on Wednesday night to the monks, sorry. It is the old simile of my life as a monk who has too many responsibilities. Every time in the morning and the evening, we chant the Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. Let them have few duties. Oops. I fail on that one. I look after this place. I look after Bodhidharma Monastery. Look after the city centre. And the nuns always come and ask me to help out at Dhammasara with their buildings and stuff, and that's not all. Santi Monastery now in Sydney, they're asking me to look after the other nuns over there. And also the Buddhist Society of Victoria in Melbourne, they're going to build a monastery soon, they want me to help over there too. And the Buddhist Society, Fellowship in Singapore, and the Brahm Center, which is named after me. And now in Korea, where are you? The Bodhidharma International Society. Was that what it's called? You've called it actually the Internet Cafe Bodhidharma International. I'm not quite sure where the Internet Cafe comes in on there. But that's another group. And you got in Colombo, we've got, what's it called? The Brahm Society? Ajahn Brahm Society, isn't it? Or something. All this stuff. And I chant every morning not to be unburdened with duties, having few duties. So you can imagine that sometimes what my life was like. And I remember a couple of years ago, it just got so heavy for me. And I was just working really hard in Nolamara Temple. And it's not the buildings, that's not the problem. It's the people and the difficulties. It's so easy to fix a tap, to fix an argument between two people. Now that really takes a lot of time. And it's the people and the problems with any organization, as you probably know. So, after a busy weekend in Nolamara, you come back and then you go in another 5 days of work at Bodhidharma Monastery and all just. And on the Monday, people would come giving the offering of the dana. And they'd come up and talk to me and say, oh, you've got such a beautiful monastery. It's so peaceful here. And I would think, I wouldn't tell them, I'd think, are you joking? There's so much work to be done here. What do you mean it's peaceful? It's driving me crazy, all this work. And for me, Bodhidharma Monastery was like an office, like a work camp.
And I couldn't appreciate it at all. I could not see it's beautiful. It wasn't peaceful, not for me. Even on Friday, someone came for the first time after we just finished our rains retreat and said, "Oh, did you have a nice rest during the rains retreat?" I say, "Look, I have to go to Thailand to Somdet Buttigieg's pay respect to him. He's my preceptor who died. I had to go to Kuala Lumpur to do a fundraising for the nuns over there and had to be teaching all the monks about 3 funerals, I think, or something. Lots of work." And I said, "It was a rest period, yes, for everybody else, for the rest. They had a nice time, but not me. I had to work and teach." So sometimes it's very busy. But when I realized what the problem was, I decided one morning a week in a monastery where I lived and was the boss, I would spend a couple of hours every Monday morning pretending I was a visitor and not an owner. Just pretending. So if somebody came up and said, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm, I need to talk to you about my meditation." I say, "Sorry, I'm not the abbot today. I'm only visiting." If a monk said, "Oh, no, this needs fixing up." I say, "Not my problem. I'm not the abbot. I'm not the teacher. I'm only a visitor." And it was wonderful being a visitor to the monastery which you were the abbot, rather than an abbot. Because you could see the whole monastery in a totally different light. I could see it as you see it. Beautiful, peaceful. Because if you're a visitor and you go home, if you go home and you pretend to be a visitor, not the owner, you're not going to wash the dishes. How many of you visit somebody else's house and wash their dishes for them? You do. Crazy. No. How many of you go and visit somebody else's house? I suppose you wash the dishes here. For us, yeah. Okay, fair enough. But when you go to somebody else's house, a friend's house, you don't wash the dishes for them. When you go to a restaurant, you know, you don't say, "Oh, can I wash the dishes?" That's only if you can't pay. If you're a visitor, you have no responsibilities. So you just enjoy. And doing that, I could have 2 hours of perfect peace, no responsibilities. I didn't have to fix up anything, didn't have to answer any emails. For two hours a week, I was not Ajahn Brahm. I was just a visitor, just like you. And I said, why not we transfer that to meditation? So when I meditate, it's not my meditation anymore, I'm just visiting. I don't care if I've got defilements or not defilements, I don't care if I'm peaceful or not peaceful, none of my business. I'm just going to sit here and enjoy. It's a wonderful way of letting go of wanting. Being a visitor, not an owner. Because as soon as you own your body, then you have to be responsible for it. As soon as you own your own mind, then you have to start developing it. But if you look at your mind, "It's nothing to do with me," then you can let it go and all your wanting stops. Then you become peaceful. That's how we use, you know, some of these great teachings of the Buddha of non-self. Because sometimes, you know, anatta, non-self, it can be a great way to think hours and hours and hours and work out what that means as a philosophy. That's a total waste of time. Instead of philosophizing and thinking about it, you can just say, what does it mean, not mine? It's not mine. I don't own anything. And that gives you a great amount of freedom. You don't own your husband. You don't own your wife. So let them go. Whatever they want to do, it's their problem. Nothing to do with me. I don't own my kids. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could think of your kids and say, they're not mine. Somebody else's problem. That's why grandparents have such a wonderful relationship with their grandchildren. Because they don't own them. Parents own their children. You know what I mean. You know, your mum and dad, they own you. They're always telling you what to do. Even though you're 40, 50 years of age. You know, I won't say who this is. There's one Australian girl, and she wanted to join
Dhammasava Monastery. Really good girl. And a good candidate. But her mother wouldn't let her. I said, how old are you? 51, she said. Isn't that crazy? 51 years old and her mother's still telling her what to do. And she's a really tough lady, really good girl. I just couldn't believe when she said that. So the grandparents, they say, oh yeah, off you go, enjoy it. Because grandparents don't own their grandchildren. That's why the grandchildren love them to bits. So be careful as a parent, don't own your kids. You know, they're just, you come into your body, and then they go out again. You can't control them anyway, so you might as well realize that early on in your life and let them go, and you have a much better relationship with them. But this is with your own body and your own mind. Can you treat your mind like your grandparents treat you? My grandma, I will never forget her. Every time I went to visit her, any time of the day, do you want some chips? But it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I don't care. Do you want some? Yeah, okay. So she was not what she was doing. Cut up some potatoes and fry me some chips. And she'd catch hell from my mum. What are you feeding my son chips for in the afternoon? He won't be eating his dinner. It's bad for his health. And my grandma said, I don't care. If that's what he wants, that's what he gets. How can you not love a grandma like that? Now, can you love your mind like that? This beautiful, I don't own it. I'm just going to care for it. Which means no wanting. Opening the door of your heart to your own mind, no matter what it is, means you're not trying to change it, you're not trying to make it different. All the wanting finishes. And if you can try and do that, there's nothing much to think about anymore. There's no problems to solve. It's not your business. That's why, in order to make this, you know, idea, this simile, really, really strong in you, one of the little sayings you can keep repeating to yourself during your meditation, and people do this, and they say that they've come on these retreats and they've heard this again and again and again. The reason we do this, it is brainwashing. If you watch the TV, apparently the adverts are not just come on once, they come on again and again and again, because they realize only through repetition does it actually get into your brain, into your subliminal consciousness, if I can say that correctly, and work. And so these people are meditating, so I was meditating here and I heard your voice. None of my business. None of my... I'm not speaking to you, that's how it gets in there. So that's a great little saying, none of my business. What a beautiful saying that is when you're meditating. You're a visitor, you're not an owner. So you're meditating here, your mind's going crazy. None of my business. It's not my mind, do whatever you want. How peaceful are you then? The body is tired, none of my business. There's just silly thoughts coming to mind, none of my business. Great nimittas coming to mind, beautiful images, none of my business. That's the trouble with people, when the bad stuff comes in, yeah, none of my business. When the good stuff, yes, this is my business. Jhanas, I want this. Be careful. When you have none of your business, it means you're not attached to anything. You can't want anything. You're totally content whatever happens. You're just like a visitor enjoying the scenery with nothing to do in the whole world. You're letting go of wanting. My goodness, you experience what peace is like. The end of wanting. Contentment. Just sitting here having a wonderful time. You'll find in meditation, if you want something, if you have a goal, many of you may have come here and had, well, last time I came here, maybe I got delightful breath. You read all my book. I would read my book if I was me. All the book about delightful breath. They say, I got that last time, but nimittas. Nimittas, beautiful lights in the mind. I've already told you about this. Nimitta, this is what I want. This is my goal. I'm going to get nimitta, okay? Well, you just got a nimitta flashing, but this time, you're really going to go for it and get the real nimittas for a long period of time. That's what you're going to do. If you come in here with a mind like that, you are going to get so frustrated, you might as well leave now, because you're not going to get anything. You're wanting. That is the problem. It stops stillness happening.
more wind is blowing your mind and making it move, making it agitated. So instead, we get into this beautiful present moment and we stay there and enjoy the stillness. Now, number two, how stillness develops. Old story of when I was a Buddhist in UK. You know, there were so few other Buddhists. There's an article coming out about me in the West Australian soon. The editor was just emailed me last week for some more questions. And they asked me about, you know, how I became a Buddhist. And I mentioned I just read a couple of books and I realized I already was a Buddhist. And for about 2 years, I was the only Buddhist I knew in the whole of Europe. I didn't know any other Buddhists. I didn't see any until I went became a lecturer. Until I went up to Cambridge and became a student. And in the university, they had all these different clubs and societies. And they had arranged that at the beginning of the year, all the freshmen were invited to go to this society's fair, where all the clubs and societies, they were spruiking, you know, for members, you know, trying to get new members. And I remember there was the Hare and Hounds Society, fox hunting. This is Cambridge, okay? You can join the fox hunting society and dress up and go on horses chasing these poor little animals on a Sunday morning if you wanted to. You know, the Astronomical Society, but almost the first little group I saw in there, they had a Buddhist Society of Cambridge. And I thought, wow, there's actually a Buddhist society in this place? There's other Buddhists? And I always remember going up to the store and saying, I want to join. And this guy on the counter, another student, said, no, you don't have to join. Just come and see. You know, ehi passiko. Just come and listen. If you like it, maybe later on you can join. I said, no, I want to join. I'm a Buddhist. No, you don't understand. You don't have to join. It's free and easy. And I said, I am a Buddhist. I want to join. Here is £1 note. Sign me up. And I always remember that because the guy behind the counter became a very close friend. He was also into science. He's retired now, but he was a professor of theoretical physics at London University. And it's fresh in my mind because I was just reading this book by Rupert Sheldrake, and this fellow is mentioned in there many times. He reviewed the draft for him, one of my close friends, Bernard Carr. And it's wonderful just, you know, these, how you actually meet people like this. But in those days, there were so few places you could go to listen to a Buddhist talk, and especially to meditate. So there was a Zen monastery opened up in the north of England. So I went there to do a meditation retreat. But it was a different type of meditation than I'd ever done before, because in that place, you would sit in a line facing the wall. And the teacher would walk behind you with a big Zen stick. And they would use it as well. If you started nodding, they would tap you on the shoulder and then whack! That's what they used to do. I never got whacked. It worked. You only need one person in the room to get whacked and everybody wakes up. Fortunately, there was one person who was more sleepy than I was. He got whacked first and all my sleepiness disappeared. I was... It was really funny. But you know, they still do that. I was in Hong Kong recently and, you know, you meet all the other monks and get the gossip about what's happening in Buddhism. And this monkey just came over from mainland China, you know, just doing some business in Hong Kong, having breakfast together. And he was laughing all over his face when he told the story. This one of these masters in mainland China, in a Zen monastery, he tried that, you know, with a Zen stick on one of the meditation retreat. And one of his disciples, this middle-aged lady, was nodding. And he whacked her on the back. And she got out her mobile phone and called the police. And that poor monk, the poor monk was arrested. So you just can't do that anymore. Not in mainland China. a true story. A poor monk. But anyway, I went to this. But the interesting part of this retreat, you know, you had to meditate with your eyes open, which I'd never done that before. You know, Theravada, we always close our eyes. So keep your eyes open and always ready to try anything for the first time. And it was weird. After 15 minutes, the wall vanished. It just wasn't there anymore. And that was really strange. Now, I was about 20, 21 at the time. You know, in the 60s, anything weird and strange, you know, you were really into. And what's going on here? And of course, you know, I was a scientist. I knew enough about the nature of sensory experience, especially how the brain works, to know that your brain is only wired to notice things which change. If there's a sound in the background which is constant, after a short while you can't hear it anymore. We all know that. There's a sensation in your body which is constant. After a while you can't feel it. It's the first time I realized you could do that with seeing as well. I was just facing this whitewashed wall, and because nothing was changing, the brain turned off. Couldn't see anymore. It was gone. And that was one of the examples which I understood, which gave me a clue into why stillness leads to these incredibly deep states of mind. You sit perfectly still, comfortably, as I keep on saying. Because if you've got an ache or a pain, the body cannot turn off. Even like at sleep at night, if you've got a headache or a stomach ache, it keeps you awake. You know, because, you know, this noise, the body is excited. It can't be still enough for it to disappear. Or even if there's noise, bang, of the door, please be look after one another in the cottages. You're allowed to come and go whenever you want to. But in your cottage, when you get to the front of the door and you open the door, when you come out again, please imagine you are burglar. Okay, if you imagine you're a burglar, you don't make any noise. Now, burglars are not the most intelligent of people. You are far more intelligent than a burglar, so you should be able to make less noise than a burglar does. So you open the front door of your cottage, and no one hears you come in. You walk very softly into your front of your room, and you open the door. No one hears you come in. No one hears you go out. Because when you're coming and going, you think, burglar. And at the very least, after this retreat, when you go back to your countries, you'll have another profession just in case. I shouldn't say that. But it's nice to be able to be quiet. And you can do that if you really want to. But it is a constant noise, such as, you know, the rain or the wind or the traffic in the distance. After a while you can't hear it. It's a constant noise. Now, this is what happens when we sit comfortably. The body is reasonably the same, and after a while it vanishes. We have our eyes closed, and if you notice, when you close your eyes, you're actually seeing like a wall the inside of your eyelids. And after a while, that doesn't change. So the sense of sight turns off. It's not you're seeing blackness, you're not seeing at all. The sense has turned off. And smelling and tasting, that's very easy to turn off. So don't, you know, go chewing something. You know, when you meditate, we don't chew gum when we're meditating, so that will keep the senses going. And also, I often mention that in meditation halls, we often have incense. You know why they have incense? In case too many people have eaten beans. And if you have eaten beans and you have got trouble with your digestion, you're passing a lot of wind, please sit in the back. That means there's no one behind you. Don't sit in the front because everybody behind you will catch it. Gross shim is really good. I'm into that. So, yeah. So the senses, The difficult one, the two difficult ones to let go of is feeling and sound. Those are the ones which disturb you in meditation. But if you are reasonably still and you don't move and you're not thinking, things disappear and vanish. And after a while, you can't feel your body anymore. It's gone. That is such a blissful experience. You don't feel hot or cold anymore. You don't feel itches or aches. Body's vanished. So you have actually one thing which is always moving, which is your breath, which is why the breath is part of the most important meditation stage. When your body is still and disappears, the last thing which is moving is your breath going in and out. So we've got to try and calm that down. And it doesn't take that long when you're watching your breath go in and go out, go in and go out. After a while you become so precise with your attention, just naturally, all you ever see is just one moment of breath, the moment of breath happening now. And it's not much different than the moment of breath which happens next, which happens next. The breath becomes smooth. So there's hardly any difference between an in-breath and an out-breath. So the breath is the same. It's only when the breath gets this beautiful sense of sameness, beginning, middle, end, in-breath or out-breath, only then can it disappear. It becomes still. Stillness is the cause for disappearance. For those of you who know some Pali, it's from that stillness you get what we call viraga, which is the fading away of things. And then nirodha, things cease, they turn off. And so part of the purpose of stillness, or the result of stillness, is so all your five senses can stop. All your thinking stops and vanishes. No thoughts, no movement, no body. And what's left? Your mind. This amazing thing which some scientists say doesn't exist. Now you're facing it. Number one, when all this busyness to do with the body and trying to get it comfortable has disappeared, when all the thoughts have vanished, that is so much bliss. For those of you who are working, when it comes to holiday time, yeah, all the work is finished. For those of you studying, when you finish your studies like they have in year 12s over here in Australia, yeah, no more schoolwork. The end of suffering is called happiness. When the body vanishes, oh, it's so much bliss. When the thought has stopped, silence, oh yeah, that's delicious. As you get into these stages, you start to experience the happiness of letting go, the bliss of things disappearing. Wow, this is cool. This is what happens. So you get into this beautiful state of mind. Well, all the five senses have disappeared. Now, normally, and things never happen normally, they always get a bit jumbled up. Normally, when the body disappears, and the thoughts have basically stopped, that's when you see this beautiful light come in the mind, called the nimitta. It's just how a human being recognizes their own mind. And if you haven't experienced a nimitta yet, this beautiful light in the mind, you will. I guarantee everybody, no matter if they're a great meditator or they never meditate at all, whether they're a Christian, a Muslim, atheist, Buddhist or whoever, everyone eventually sees a nimitta when you die, when you cark it, when you kick the bucket. You go floating out of your body. And what happens next? You go towards the light. For those of you who've had near-death experiences, or those of you who've seen them on the TV, or heard them described by people, that's what they describe. Floating out of your body, now they're dead. Number one, they have a great time.
this body sucks. I always remember that story on the BBC. Great documentary. I think I've got it somewhere. I don't know where. This woman, she died on the operating table and floating out of her body. Oh, she was so happy. So much nicer being dead than being alive. It's true. And she was having such a wonderful time that she was floating around, and then she met this other spirit and said, "I'm sorry, but you're not supposed to die yet. You have to go back." And the BBC interview, though, she was describing what happened next. She told this spirit, "No, I'm not going back. No way. We have to. I don't care. I'm not going." And they had this argument on the astral plane, or whatever it was. "You've got to go back. I don't want to go back." "No, you have to. No way." And having argued for I don't know how long, this spirit, somehow or other, got hold of this woman and actually threw her back into her body. And that's where she came to again, and she could tell the story to the BBC on the interview. But the most fascinating thing was then she screwed up her face in sheer anger. And she said, "Now when I die next time, when I really die, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find that person. I'm going to find that guy. And you wouldn't believe what I'm going to do to him. What he did to me, sending me back into this, you know, dumb old body, I'll never forgive that guy for that. Never, ever. I'm going to really sort him out when I die next time." It's really funny just seeing that interview and seeing just how upset she was of having been brought back to life again. And I like saying that because it's nice when you die. Just like when your body vanishes. It's just so lovely. In meditation, just sitting here, just no body, no aches and pains. I don't have to move my leg. Don't have to go to the toilet. Don't have to drink something, eat something, take something out of my body. It's just so nice. And your body vanishes. And the next thing which happens is, you know, people usually go and see this beautiful light, which is the same light as you see in meditation when you're still alive, just sitting here. It is just the way you see your own mind, your sixth sense. So number one, you're really getting blissed out. And why not? Have some pleasure in this meditation. That's why it is a happy path, this meditation. Really happy. Really gets you just smiling all over your face. Or as that one guy last year, unfortunately he was a heroin addict. He was trying to get off, but he stayed here a while, but eventually he couldn't stop himself. He went back again. But I remember him. I was just finishing my lunch, walking up to my hut, up that path, and he came running after me. He said, "Bum, bum, 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 I have to tell you this, I never thought it possible. I know you keep on saying that, you know, when you get into deep meditation, it's a bliss better than sex." "So yeah, I know sex, but I also know heroin. Heroin is much better than sex," he said. "But I never thought I'd say this, meditation is much better than heroin." He had a big bliss experience. Unfortunately, he wasn't strong enough to keep him off the heroin. But he said, "This is way, way, way better than sex. It's better than heroin high of an addict." Now that is what we're talking about when you let go, when you're still. Incredible bliss. And it's not just for the sake of blissing out, but also that shows you what suffering is. The great Buddhist teaching of suffering. What are you talking about, monks? You know, life is suffering. Get a life. Monks, you're just nun-nuns as well. You're just afraid of relationships, aren't you? Or you've been hurt, just like me. I had a lovely relationship when I was young. For 6 months we loved each other, and then she dumped me. And that's why I became a monk. No longer. If I can't marry that girl, then I'm going to become a monk. So romantic, isn't it? Wish it was true. So he left the world because he was heartbroken and became a monk for the next 40 years. The life story of that. It's not true at all, obviously. But yeah, you can see when we say, you know, it's suffering, now you understand why. Compared to what you get in meditation, this life stuff is not worth it. Why would you just take this stuff for when you've got this incredible bliss, when you're free of this body? That teaches you the first noble truth of suffering, of dukkha. Quite frankly, if you haven't got a deep meditation or a jhana, you haven't really got much idea of what suffering is in life. Yeah, suffering. You not get your own way, suffering, you can't get the food you like, you get sick, or you have an argument with somebody, and you know, you feel rejected. Yeah, that's suffering, but that's just superficial. See, the real thing, when the body disappears, at least you get into the mind. That's not the end, obviously, but that's giving you an indication of what's going on. So it's also for the sake of insight, and also to understand what this mind actually is. You have to face it, first of all. So we get still in order for things to disappear, so at least we can get to this stage of meditation where we can actually be face to face with this thing called the mind, which is so powerful, which is what we think we are. It's not what we are, but what we think we are. When you actually can face it by itself, you get huge amounts of understanding of what makes you tick. Who is listening to me, or rather, what's listening to me, what's watching, what does things? Because you've got it right in front of you. This is where you get your insight from. So just from something as simple as being still, being a visitor, not an owner, this is none of my business, not having goals, not trying to get somewhere, but being here, making stillness the most important thing, then you are meditating. So how do we meditate? What am I supposed to do at this stage of the retreat? Said Ajahn Brahm, I don't get it. What am I supposed to do? Please tell me something to do. It'll be wonderful. Say, okay, watch your breath. Watch your breath go in now. Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. That's so nice. I've got something to do now. I've got to watch my breath. I haven't told you that, have I? That's just giving you more things to do. Sit here and don't do anything. See how still you can be. Be in this present moment. Be here with no plans. Just content, just to be in this moment with no goals. Sitting as still as you can, not shaking the mango tree, not throwing up sticks or climbing up the thing. Opening up your heart to whatever you're experiencing right now and just see what happens. You become still and things disappear because the winds of wanting have been stopped. Just make peace, which is another word for doing nothing. Be kind, which is opening the door of your heart to this moment, and be gentle. It is basically again doing nothing. All different ways of saying the same thing. Just sit here, shut up, and be still. So there we go. So simple. Any questions? No? Good. Any questions or comments? Okay, if you don't get it, don't worry, just keep on just giving up. You're all hopeless anyway, so I've got no anticipation any of you will get anything. That's reverse psychology. When I say things like that, what does he mean I'm hopeless? I'll teach this monk, I'm not hopeless. It's a great way for motivating people, using reverse psychology. And just see what happens and enjoy it today. If you're still sleepy, just, you know, do some more what I call flat out meditation on your beds if you're still sleepy, because some of you, again, it does take a couple of days for you to get into the habit of things here. If you are just a bit tired, just go for a walk and just, you know, see where you can get to in the forest, but please don't go through the fence line, because last time on the executive retreat from Buddhist Fellowship was a couple of people, they were wandering over this fence and that fence and they got totally lost. And they knocked on the door of a neighbour who had to drive them back again. It was very, very embarrassing. So stay within the boundary fence. And you can't get lost. There's a fence all around the property. There's no way you can get lost that way. If you go through the fence, that's it. Bye-bye. And that means you can... Obviously, you can go out through the fence to Boding Diana Monastery, which is fine. And if any of you just don't like this hall to meditate, I should mention this because Boding Diana Monastery Hall has got some good energy to it. So if you don't like meditating here, just walk over to the monastery and sit in the hall over there. You're most welcome to use that hall as well for meditating. It's got some nice energy over there. So that's also for you. So you've got the whole place here for you. And there is the interviews now. So those are people who brought their names on the interview list. I'll be seeing you in a couple of minutes. So happy meditating, or rather, happy nothing doing.
Sadhu. Sadhu.